Hey guys, thanks so much for listening. If you want to support the show, go to patreon.com/frightday.
I ate a pear in a graveyard today.
What kind of pear?
It wasn't ripe enough, honestly. Fright Day. I'm your host, Bob. Excuse me? I'm your host, Byron. And murder gets monotonous. But can a young, hip YouTube video artist rekindle this man's passion for killing? Tonight, we jam out to Patrick Bryce's Creep 2. And last week, we discussed the brutal details surrounding the death of a Hollywood hopeful. Tonight, let's figure out how those heinous things happened to Elizabeth Short. It's the Black Dahlia Part 2 in this week's edition of Byron's Serial Corner. I'm joined tonight by Kelly.
Sam, can we do this thing tonight where anytime he says Kelly, you talk, and anytime he says Sam, I talk?
And Sam, and don't do that.
Hey, guys.
I thought it sounded fun. Mix things up a bit.
It's a night of sequels, guys.
It is.
I like sequels.
Couldn't be happier.
Yeah.
Another reason I'm happy. The Roswell incident of Captain Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracy special presentation it's here. The physical cassette has arrived.
And they are...
glorious.
Yeah, I'm not just saying that because it's ours.
I want to say it's the most amazing inanimate object I've ever created.
How many things have you made?
You're not artistic.
With that woman costume you made for
That's
your daughter
true.
Is pretty good.
Mr. I'm not artistic, you right. son of a bitch.
I just need to broaden my definition of art.
And it's available now to you guys. If you're a Patreon patron at the $4 level and higher, it's free. Plus shipping and handling. So if you haven't received your copy, send us a message on Patreon. If you aren't a Patreon patron, you should probably do that. But if you don't want to be, it's shop.frightday.com. And remember, there's only 100 of these, and they're going fast.
Even if you don't have a tape deck, they look great on your shelf.
I did find a tape deck at Goodwill, Sam.
Did you?
Yeah.
I think you can do that in most Goodwills, so that would be a way to
You'd
listen
be surprised.
To this. Here's the thing, guys. I really am proud of this. Obviously, most of the work was Byron editing, but...
Oh, come on. You did months of research, Sam.
I mean, I really did.
Sam left you twice.
Three times.
I don't mean to bring this up.
Why do
talk
I
about
keep
the third
coming
one.
Back?
Yeah, the thing about it is, guys... it's kind of my magnum opus. It's really important to me. And I will cry if you all don't listen
I mean,
to it.
Come on now. Don't threaten them with tears.
No, I will.
It's not fair or fun.
I use emotional weapons. That's just my thing.
You're a bin Laden of the heart.
Yeah.
And soon you'll be dead in the ocean. Sam, what'd you watch this week?
So not horror, but definitely dark sci-fi. I got to see Blade Runner 2049. And I... loved it.
It's about time, Sam.
The original is one of my favorite movies, and the sequel, I would actually go out on a limb and say it's as good as the original.
Really?
Just spectacular. It was beyond a movie. It was a religious experience. Ryan Gosling is awesome because he's always awesome in everything except La La Land.
He saved jazz.
Harrison Ford is Harrison Ford. Just such a cool universe. I think everyone should go see this movie. It's long, but I never once found it dragging. It just kind of pulls you along, and it's very... I read a review that described it as narcotic, and I can't think of a better way to put it than that, because it just feels like you're kind of floating through this vast, empty, yet teeming future. It's gorgeous. It sounds good. It looks good. I just go see this movie.
In case you're wondering, Sam went and saw it without me.
Well, he went with his buddies. Give him a break.
Mm-hmm. You know what I watched by myself while he went and saw that with his buddies?
You know, I'm curious. What?
Well, you see, I finished season one of The Exorcist, and now I'm on season two.
God, you're really all in on this.
I am. This is what I do. I go all in on things. What I think is interesting about The Exorcist is the...
Hey, Kelly.
Yeah?
What happened to Braindead?
I need to finish it. You're
Please.
Absolutely right. Okay. I'm just into being scared, not laughing this month, because
I mean,
it's October.
I mean, spooky. I don't know.
Well...
Season two.
I don't want to spoil things for anyone, but there is some carryover cast, but there's also a whole new story. It's kind of like an interesting regular series, anthology series fusion what I really like about this second season that I think Byron especially is going to be on board with, some of the actors are going to feel pretty familiar. For example, John Cho, also known as Harold.
I like John Cho.
Brianna Hildebrand.
That one doesn't ring a bell.
Oh, she should ring a bell. She's from Tragedy Girls.
Come on now. Of course.
Yeah, she played Sadie.
The young lady.
Quite good in the show. The acting continues to surprise me in both seasons of this series, and I am really hoping that this is one that continues, and it's not a situation where I jump on in the second season only to watch it get canceled.
Well, two is better than one.
It's better than none, too. So, yay. Watch The Exorcist. We'll discuss it.
I mean,
in a future episode.
Yeah, maybe I'll watch it. I don't know. I spent what little leisure time I had tattooing my knees until 3 a.m. while finishing David Fincher's Mindhunter.
None of that was metaphor.
Honestly, I talked about this last week. You got Ed Kemper. You got Jerry Brudos, the shoe fetish slayer. And we got a second season tease of Dennis Rader, aka the BTK killer, peppered throughout this season. I am so in. I probably shouldn't have jogged yesterday because my knees hurt really bad. But, you know, I had a fun weekend. That's all I did because I was too busy editing Catherine Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies number 16, which is available now to Patreon patrons.
Did you know that 16's my lucky number?
It seemed like an unlucky episode for you, Kelly, because you were pretty freaked the whole time. We talked EVPs.
Yes, and I actually have had multiple nightmares about that whole situation.
Well, you have to listen to figure out what exactly happened.
Byron surprised me with something that wasn't welcome.
It was a lot of fun.
It was.
A lot of scare.
Settle down. All right, relax. Come on now.
Did you just have an aneurysm burst? Yes. Is that right? Do aneurysms burst or do you have an aneurysm?
I think an aneurysm is something bursting. So it feels redundant to say an aneurysm burst.
So Kelly, fake things scare you. You know what scares me? Reality.
That's dumb.
Last week, we talked a little bit about a horrific thing that happened to a person that was alive at a certain point. Now she's dead. Elizabeth Short, aka the Black Dahlia.
Oh, man. More horrible things than I realized happened to her.
Yeah, she had a hard exit.
What do you say we crack this case wide open?
Do we have to go back into Byron's cereal corner?
Fire emergency.
Please don't talk to Elizabeth. I'm sorry.
They found the bodies of at least 3 young boys, 6 more bodies under the John Gacy house. And
one longtime acquaintance describes Dahmer as one weird dude.
Tuned for Byron's Serial Corner.
Like I mentioned, last week we discussed the horrific murder and unsolved case of the aspiring actress Elizabeth Short, posthumously known as the Black Dahlia. Kelly, did you have a lot of fun?
I learned a
this
lot.
This week I'll be running down the list of suspects, discussing motives and evidence, as well as giving you my personal opinion, and I'm very curious to know at the end of this what you and Sam think.
Can I tell you what I think right now?
No, why would you do that now at the beginning of the segment?
Well, because we should get it out of the way so I can talk about ghosts.
I think it was Jack Ruby.
I think that Sam's right, and Kelly.
It wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald, I'll tell you that
all
much.
All right, Kelly, you're
never is.
Let's start with the man whose address book was in her possession. You remember his name?
No.
It's Mark Hansen.
Hansen.
We talked a little bit about Mark in episode 1. He was the boyfriend of Elizabeth's roommate. He also commented to police that she was crying and scared prior to hopping onto that bus, if you recall. On January 8th, 1947, Elizabeth called Mark in Los Angeles from San Diego, making him one of the last people to talk to Elizabeth before her disappearance.
So you say one of. We don't have an official timeline, right? So we aren't really sure who the exact last person was.
Not exactly.
Okay. All right. Just making sure. It could be a number of different people that saw her last, aside from the killer, of course.
Alive, that is.
Yes.
When the LAPD interrogated Mark on their conversation, he had several contradictory statements. Regarding that address book, though, he admitted that it was his, but that he had never used it, and that he gave it to her as a gift, which I think is a bit strange. Back then, Sam, were things that were personalized harder to come across?
Well, yeah, you had to actually go to a shop. Like,
I like that Sam is the official authority on the 1940s.
I mean, look at him. He's got the zoot suit on. Who else am I supposed to ask?
Flipping a silver dollar here.
All right.
He does call me a tomato all the time.
All right. Los Angeles District Attorney files also indicated that Hansen tried to seduce Elizabeth at one point, but she refused.
Hold on. So he tried to seduce her. She said, no go, Mr. Man. And he said, okay, have my agenda.
Well, Hansen was also linked to three other suspects, all medical doctors, which of course, as you'll remember from last week, they were of higher suspicion due to the precision that Elizabeth was cut in half.
It's a bit Jack the Ripper-like, the detail and intricacy of the
Very
wounds.
Very much so, yeah. These suspects included Dr. Patrick S. O'Reilly, Dr. M.M. Schwartz, and Dr. Arthur McGinnis Fault.
Schwartz McDuff. Dumpy Schwartz McDuff.
Hansen is one of the first suspects in the case, considered the prime suspect during the grand jury investigation that actually happened in 1949.
Slow pokes.
No official charges were ever brought against him, and he actually died of natural causes in 1964. He had no criminal record and no known history of violence. Some theorists believe that he could have ties to gangsters, but who didn't at the time, honestly?
Well, it's true. It was a cool time. Everybody got to be friends with gangsters. It's much harder to be friends with gangsters these days. The fun old timey ones are real hard to come by.
I don't know how fun they were, Sam.
Yeah.
Were they fun?
Were you friends with them, Sam?
I'm not friends with anybody.
Oh.
Huh, that's very sad. Thanks for... So let's dig into the physician connections a little bit, starting with a man named Patrick S. O'Reilly. Patrick and Elizabeth were acquaintances, as I said, through Mark, whose clubs he frequented. He also allegedly, quote, attended sex parties at Malibu.
Was this Bill O'Reilly's father?
There are probably more than one
sexual harassment
O'Reilly lineages.
I'm just saying, there sound like some similarities there.
So. I don't think this Malibu sex party is a huge deal, but Patrick had a more obvious dark side. He had been convicted of assault with a deadly weapon for, quote, taking his secretary to a motel and sadistically beating her almost to death, apparently for no other reason other than to satisfy his sexual desires without intercourse, according to district attorney files. To me, that sounds a lot like attempted murder.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Wow. So he had a history.
A bit of a history. Files also noted that Patrick's right pectoral had been surgically removed, which was similar to the mutilation that was seen on Elizabeth's body.
That was his souvenir?
I don't know.
I think he did it to himself, and that was like his thing. It's like removing that portion of people's anatomy, including his own.
Oh, and get this. He was married to the daughter of an LAPD captain. But of course, we'll get more into potential police cover-ups later in this episode.
Yeah.
Moving on, another doctor. This one named George Hodel. In October of 1949, reportedly...
I think he did it.
He
Ghosts?
October 1949, reportedly three witnesses testified to seeing him having sex with his 14-year-old daughter.
Jesus.
Yeah. He was later acquitted of these charges in December of that year. It was this molestation that grabbed the attention of the LAPD, who put him under surveillance from February 18th to March 27th of 1950. Hoping that George would spill something about the murder, they actually installed two microphones in his home that were monitored by 18 detectives. Most of the transcript was, quote, dull at first. George having sex, yelling at his secretary, talking about money problems. However, Kelly, on February 19th, 1950, there was something more horrific in this recording.
Was it my ghost noise? It wasn't. Okay, all right, I'm picking up that it wasn't.
8:25 p.m., quote, woman screamed. Woman screamed again. Another woman screaming.
Wow.
Two women screaming. Later the same day, George was recorded talking to his confidant.
Realizing there was nothing I could do. Put a pillow over her head and cover her with a blanket. Get in a taxi. Expired, 12:59. They thought there was something fishy. Anyway, now they may have figured it out. Killed her.
Ooh.
That's relatively damning.
Yeah,
I guess.
Just say killed her.
The surveillance routinely continued, catching a highly incriminating statement.
Supposing I did kill the Black Dahlia.
I've been practicing.
They couldn't prove it now. They can't talk to my secretary anymore because she's dead.
Well,
that's convenient.
This secretary was Ruth Spaulding, who had died from a, quote, drug overdose.
Ooh.
And it was because of these captured comments that he was actually investigated for her murder. Apparently, he had been present at the time of her death and had burnt some of her things before the police were called.
Seriously?
But guess what? The case was dropped due to lack of evidence.
Wow, because the evidence was burned.
What? the hell was the LAPD doing?
Oh my God.
Documents were later found indicating that Ruth was planning to blackmail George, who had possibly been misdiagnosing patients, billing them for lab tests, treatments, and unnecessary prescriptions, just being a general bad doc.
Yeah.
In May of 2016, The Guardian published a great piece titled, I Know Who Killed the Black Dahlia. My own father.
I mean, that's a catchy header.
So it was from George's son, a former LAPD detective named Steve Hodel, and the 15 years of evidence that he cataloged. He also wrote two books about this case, Black Dahlia Avenger and The Black Dahlia Avenger 2. These books claim that his father was responsible for her murder, along with other unsolved murders at the time. I'm going to have links to all these resources in the show notes of this episode on Friday.com because I think it's very interesting.
It is interesting.
According to George's roommate, Elizabeth was one of his, quote, girlfriends. Also noting that George often spent time around the Biltmore Motel, of course, where she was seen last. A nude image of Elizabeth was found in George's possessions.
Well, that's a bit of a
Tamar Hodel, one of George's daughters, stated that her mother told her that her father had been out partying the night of the murder and stated, quote,
they'll never be able to prove I did that murder.
Huh. So it sounds like he did a murder.
It seems like he did a murder. George actually abandoned his family, moved to the Philippines where reports of rape and violence continued until his death in 1999.
So he sounds a lot like Elizabeth's father, actually.
Yeah, bit of an abandoner, but add in a bunch of rape and potential murder.
Everyone in the orbit of any of these cases is just, it never ceases to amaze me, the just dregs of humanity that crawl out of the woodwork.
I mean, honestly, guys, there is some strong evidence here that George is our guy.
I told you before you even, I said he did it.
Yeah.
That's all you needed to know.
But we got another surgeon. This is Walter Bailey.
No way.
You don't think Walter did it?
No way.
Walter lived a block south of where her body was discovered. He moved in October 1946 after leaving his wife. Bailey's daughter, Barbara, was a friend of Elizabeth Short's sister, Virginia, and brother-in-law, Adrian West.
So we've got a bit of a connection. It's still, no, he didn't do it.
She had been the matron of honor at their wedding, actually. January 1948, Walter died. Sad.
There wasn't much time to investigate him, is what you're saying.
Not really, but an autopsy showed that he had been suffering from a degenerative brain disease.
That made him murderous?
Well, they didn't know back then. They're just like, there's a big hole in his brain.
They were looking at brains in the classic horror movie. Well,
yeah, I don't know that they were
wasn't that why
skillful.
They were eating brains,
I think,
Byron.
That was why Frankenstein was so wild.
And I guess they, I mean, like in Indiana Jones, when they examined those monkey brains.
Mm-hmm.
They gobbled them. They didn't examine them.
You're talking monkey about brains. Faces of death, for sure. Walter's widow claimed that Bailey's mistress, a doctor named Alexandria Partica, had known a, quote, terrible secret about him, which was why he listed his mistress as his main beneficiary. Walter was never considered a suspect by the LAPD. Still, many conspiracy theorists, like this guy named Larry Harnish, he's a copy editor for the LA Times, they believe it was possible due to his medical knowledge, but he was 67 at the time.
Still could have done it.
You know why he could have done it?
Why?
Maybe because he cut the body in half?
Hold on, that's why he could have done it?
I'm just saying that he could have been too weak to move a full body and that maybe he cut the body in half so he can transport it.
See, I don't buy that though. I mean, the way it was placed, even though it was offset a little bit, the torso from the upper half from the bottom half, somebody meant to do that. If you cut it apart for ease of storage, you pitch it out and it just lands where it lands.
A retired FBI profiler stretched a little bit further, saying the fact that the dumping site was so close to his estranged wife's house that it could have been viewed as a veiled threat towards her. Also, remember when I said last week that it was reported that Elizabeth was telling false stories of losing a child?
Yes, and a marriage.
Yeah, well, Walter had a son who was struck by a car and killed when he was 11.
Ooh.
If he did know this, it might explain the significance of the facial mutilation that she had, as usually when people mutilate the face, it's because they're angry and it's personal.
And love.
Yeah.
Yeah, or I mean, you know, not love. That's not the right word
Extreme
for it.
Extreme emotions.
Yeah. The only interesting thing I see in Walter is that in his weakened state, that could explain why she was cut in half, but Sam...
She was arranged.
Yeah.
Whatever it was part of a ritual.
Remember that trunk recovered from the Greyhound station that I brought up last week?
Her missing trunk that had a bunch of personal belongings in it.
They were able to identify everyone in all of the images found inside. everyone except one man.
Oh boy.
Dubbed the Un-ID'd Man.
Ooh.
It's kind of a fun superhero name as well. According to a theory on the Black Dahlia Solution website, the LAPD did know who the killer was, but were unable to make it stick. The writer accuses a man named Ed Burns to be responsible for Elizabeth Short's murder, yet no other sources have ever brought up Ed Burns as a suspect. This name was never mentioned in any FBI reports or accessible LAPD files. In January of 1946, a 60-year-old woman named Suzanne Degnan was kidnapped and murdered in Chicago. Her body parts were soon found in sewers nearby. A man named William Harness was arrested for her murder after confessing. Was he just another broad confessor?
Which I just don't understand. I mean, I know there are a lot of mentally ill people in the world.
Oh, and we'll get into some of those.
But why would you confess to a murder you didn't commit? I guess it's a quick way to become famous.
Yeah. But he was arrested and linked to two additional murders, eventually sentenced to three consecutive life sentences. According to the author of The Black Dahlia Solution, Elizabeth Short had become obsessed with a woman's murder after it was published in Life magazine.
Interesting.
She would tell people in bars that she was a reporter from Boston and would give the gruesome details of the murder again and again. Sounds like my kind of girl at a bar. You know Elizabeth by now. She was always on the hunt for the man of her dreams.
Yeah, and she was not a very good hunter.
At this time, she was supposedly involved with a man named Ed Burns, who had been attending the USC School for Medicine. The two of them hit it off at first. Yeah, he believed that this was his dream girl, and she enjoyed having someone to give her money and listen to her stories. However, he was not what you would consider attractive. He was a bit of an ugly man.
What made him ugly? Give me some details.
Oh, well, some people said that he had rabbit-like features.
Rabbits don't have to be ugly.
I don't think that they're necessarily hideous, but maybe as a person.
If you slap it on a person, it'd be disquieting.
Could be. It's assumed that Elizabeth did not want to show him off to her friends, later making the man difficult to identify.
Man, I mean, that wasn't very nice of her.
The two of them have gotten together twice in Hollywood in November of 1946. Both times spending the night together in a hotel in downtown Los Angeles. Both mornings after, he would give her food and rent money before driving her back to Hollywood.
So she was,
You know, and should we get into that now?
Yeah.
I've purposely avoided any talk of her being a sex worker.
Prostitute?
Because I don't believe she was.
In the first part of the report, you talk about how she was known at the military base as a prude.
A bit of a prude, yeah. Ed was Elizabeth's best listener, always acting interested when she would talk about that Suzanne murder.
That one Suzanne
get
murder.
Get over it. There's more than that one. However, perhaps his patience wore thin. Elizabeth might have coaxed him to drive her out to Leimert Park, her lover's lane, before commenting on the irony of Degnan Boulevard going right by it. Remember, that's the last name of Suzanne, the murderer.
Yeah.
Ed could have become enraged with her, feeling as if she loved and idolized that Chicago murderer more than himself. He could have tied up Elizabeth, killed her, mutilated her body in the same fashion as Suzanne Degnan to allow them to live out this twisted interpretation of her fantasy.
Yeah.
But I don't think so. That's ridiculous.
Seems really weird.
Yeah, come on now. It's believed that Ed Burns committed suicide on March 15th, 1947, exactly 2 months after Elizabeth's murder, maybe in order to join Elizabeth in death. His suicide note read as follows.
To whom it may concern, I have waited for the police to capture me for the Black Dahlia killing, but have not. I am too much of a coward to turn myself in, so this is the best way out for me. I couldn't help myself for that, or this. Sorry, Mary.
Whoa.
When LAPD discovered the body, they were likely able to identify him. If the police had followed the message on the note, their next step should have been to revisit evidence in the Black Dahlia case. If they looked back at the photographs of Elizabeth, her friends, and her lovers from the trunk that they retrieved from the Greyhound station, they should have been able to connect the dead man to the unidentified photographs with Elizabeth. However, the LAPD would not come out to the public to say that the dead man was the Black Dahlia's killer. And the author proposes that instead the LAPD decided to keep the truth about the murders hidden.
Why?
I think this is nonsense. This is just a weird urban legend story.
So, yeah. Hold on. We don't know that that guy who died was the guy in the photos?
No, you don't. Hmm. We don't know what that guy looks like. He just looks like a rabbit man.
Hmm.
Can't be that many of them running around.
I don't buy that story. It's interesting.
Hmm.
It's fun.
I don't know. I like that story the best.
Really?
I mean, aside from maybe like ghost or alien versions.
But... Leslie Dillon. This then 27-year-old gentleman was a bellhop and an aspiring writer. Who in Hollywood isn't? And, oh yeah, a former mortician's assistant. In October 1948, Dillon wrote to the LAPD psychiatrist Dr. J. Paul DeRiver about the Black Dahlia case. Dillon, writing from Florida, told DeRiver that he had heard about Elizabeth Short's case from a, quote, True Detective magazine, which was both common and popular at the time, right, Sam?
Yes, absolutely. It was a, you know...
True Detective.
Where DeRiver spoke on the case, he wanted to hear DeRiver's Dahlia theories because he had an interest in sadism and sexual psychopaths and wanted to write a book on those subjects again. Who in Hollywood doesn't want to do this?
I know, it's true.
Although Dillon never confessed to the murder, he did have an idea of his own, claiming that his friend Jeff Connors was Short's killer.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my buddy Jeff did that one.
Yeah, it's Jeff Connor, you
That's
know.
That's Jeff.
As DeRivers and Dillon wrote back and forth from Florida to Los Angeles, DeRiver started to believe that Connors was not a real man.
Really?
And this is not an outdated insult in any fashion.
Huh.
He just truly didn't think that it was a separate person. DeRiver thought that Dillon himself had murdered Elizabeth Short and had developed Connors as a figment of his imagination to cope with a gruesome act.
Interesting.
In December 1948, Dillon agreed to meet DeRiver, and DeRiver offered three potential locations: Phoenix, Los Angeles, and Sin City.
All those places are terrible.
A bunch of bad places. Dillon was uneasy about the LA meetup and chose instead to meet in Vegas. DeRiver and undercover LAPD officer Sergeant John O'Mara met Dillon there. DeRiver interrogated Dillon and O'Mara acted as his, quote, bodyguard, which I imagine he did a lot more things to this man's body than just guard it.
Fair enough.
The interview was recorded. Sam.
Yes, sir.
Last week you proved to me that you have a fun voice.
Oh, his old-timey voice is very fun.
So you be DeRiver, and I'll be the creepy guy named Dillon. This is the interview. Here we go.
What do you think the killer did with her hair? He shaved off the private parts of the body of Elizabeth Short.
I don't think the killer, such as he would probably have thrown the hair into a toilet and flushed it.
What do you think a killer such as he was would do with a piece of flesh with a tattoo on it after he cut it off her thigh?
Oh, well, I think he would probably have thrown that down the toilet and flushed it.
The following is from another recording. First of all, weird dude Dillon is.
Yeah, squirrely.
Wow. Whoa.
You're the one who murdered Elizabeth Short.
Dr. DeRiver, the trouble with this is that you first reach your own conclusions about this case, and then you try to dig up things to prove that your conclusions are correct.
What do you think I am, a child? What do you mean by talking to me that way? I'm a person who's been around.
Wow. These were a couple weird sounding dudes.
You guys can clap or whatever.
Yeah, I assume everyone is at home right now or in their car.
Or
better in your
some
car.
Sort of podcast
both
award.
Hands. Clap with both hands in your car.
I mean, yes, you are.
Thanks. The undercover officer also remembered Dillon talking about bleeding bodies prior to embalming them by making an incision in the, quote, upper thigh, inserting a tube to drain the blood. You know, typical mortician's assistant small talk kind of thing. Dillon had hoped to return to California with DeRiver and O'Mara to show them his friend, Jeff Connors. When they arrived in San Francisco, they searched for Jeff, but had difficulty locating him. The LAPD confronted Dillon, trapping him with the purpose of getting a confession out of him. Because, as Sam knows, bullied confessions are the best confessions.
Oh, yeah. The only way you can be sure you get what you need is by applying a little bit of physical force and then a threat of more force.
He eventually offered the police intimate details about Elizabeth Short's murder that the investigators had even struggled to explain. Dillon had been held against his will at a hotel near LA, obviously against his rights. An undercover officer handcuffed him and officially took him into custody at the Highland Park Station on January 10th, 1949. Detectives Finnis Brown and Harry Hansen questioned Dillon on the evening of January 10th. The following night, the LAPD received a call from San Francisco saying they had found Jeff Connors.
Mm-hmm.
His real name was Artie Lane. No, not the comedian. That's Artie. That's Artie Lang.
Right.
Oh, I don't know Artie Lang.
Really?
I know Archie Bunker. He wasn't very nice.
Sure. Lane lived in Los Angeles at the time of Short's murder and had worked as a maintenance man at Columbia Studios, which is a favorite hangout place for Elizabeth. By the end of 1949, the LAPD concluded that Dylan was most likely in San Francisco when the murder took place. However, they could not conclusively place him there. In fact, the police could not account for Dylan's whereabouts between January 9th and January 15th, 1947.
Well, those are the very specific days that, she was...
considered missing.
Well, tortured, most likely.
Well, probably. That was a long torture week. Dylan later filed a $100,000 claim against the city of Los Angeles for how he was treated in the case, yet the lawsuit was dropped when the LAPD discovered that he was wanted by the Santa Monica police for robbing a hotel while working as a bellhop there.
Wow. So he's sure he didn't have any rights. He was a criminal.
Yeah. The scandal surrounding Dylan and DeRivers' involvement, the Black Dahlia investigation, aided in triggering a 1949 grand jury investigation into the Elizabeth Short case and police cover-up and corruption in Los Angeles.
Isn't this the period of time that L.A. Confidential takes place?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It sounds exactly like L.A. Confidential.
I know. I feel like I need to rewatch that now.
I've never seen it.
And then I need to watch the Black Dahlia murder because I never saw that one.
Me either. Another pretty odd tale. I'd love to get your opinions on that.
It's a great tale.
Dylan's just a weird dude.
I mean, just squirrely. Either a squirrely guy or obviously mentally has some issues, like legitimate issues there.
He's a mortician in the 1940s.
Yeah, it attracted a certain type. Yeah.
Still does, doesn't it?
Mortician folk are the best folk.
I'm not saying that it attracts a bad type. I'm just saying it attracts a certain type. Like, I'm just going to go ahead and throw this out there. I could see either of you being morticians. You guys really don't necessarily like talking to people.
Dylan's just a weird dude.
You think so?
Yeah, but speaking of odd people, Joseph A. Dumas. Wait. It's Dumas.
Dumas?
Dumas.
That's just fancy.
Wow.
Remember the dumbass commercial?
Hey, dumbass.
That was a lot of fun.
Do you remember that?
He was a 29-year-old soldier stationed in Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Hmm.
One of the many false confessors to the Black Dahlia murder. He came forward just a few weeks after. Joseph offered LAPD detectives a 50-page statement on how he had dated Elizabeth on January 9th or 10th in 1947 before blacking out for several days.
Who hasn't been there?
That's not good.
Who blacks out for several days?
I don't know. He believed that he had killed Elizabeth during this blackout. However, he was seen at Fort Dix in New Jersey on January 10th, 11th, 12th, and 17th of 1947, making it impossible for him to have either dated or killed Elizabeth Short. The papers stopped covering his story after that, knowing that his confession must be a hoax. He popped up again in the papers in September of 1948, when he was busted in Evanston, Illinois for car theft.
I've been to Evanston, Illinois.
How is it?
It's actually really pretty. It's where Northwestern is.
A lot of cars?
I mean, now.
So he told police that he was held for 83 days in an army detention at Fort Dix after being connected to the murder of his, quote, wife, Elizabeth Short.
Whoa.
Joseph claimed to have known her as Eunice Fortune.
What?
Eunice Fortune.
Okay, who gives up the name Elizabeth in favor of Eunice?
You know, technically she probably shifted into Elizabeth for her Hollywood persona, if this man is telling the truth.
Is he?
The Evanston police contacted the LAPD and quickly determined that his statement was false, as his confession to Elizabeth Short's murder had already been disproven. His claim that he had been married to Elizabeth in 1937 was also impossible, as she would have been 12 years old at the time.
Well, I mean, if he was Jerry Lee Lewis, it was possible.
Oh, gross.
Right?
Joseph was permanently cleared of any involvement in the murder. However, he continued to claim that he killed Elizabeth Short every single time that he was arrested for various offenses well into the 1950s.
Well, he sounds like he's got some issues.
Yeah, it's sad, but a fun story nonetheless.
Well, interesting. I think I'll stick with interesting.
Speaking of criminals, Jack Anderson Wilson, a lifelong criminal and alcoholic, he was originally a suspect in the Cleveland Torso Murders case, which occurred in Cleveland between 1937 and 1938. This is something I'm sure I'll be talking about at some point in the future. LAPD specialists investigated these murders in 1947 and later marked down any connections that they would have with the Black Dahlia case. Wilson had been interviewed by author John Gilmore while he was researching his book Severed. After Wilson's death on February 4th, 1982, Gilmore claimed that Wilson had been associated with Elizabeth Short's death.
Did she like volleyball?
Excuse me?
Did she like volleyball?
You know, I didn't read that.
Why is, was the volleyball even a thing then?
Wilson.
Oh, okay. Bad.
Oh,
bad.
That was up. I liked it better when I didn't know what that all was.
Right. Hey, I'm going to pack up my stuff.
I mean, I thought that was the best one of the night.
When Wilson was still alive, Gilmore had made a different claim to the Herald Express on January 17th, 1982. In Severed, Gilmore claimed that Detective John St. John was about to, quote, close in on Wilson for the Black Dahlia murder based on the information Gilmore had provided him. This statement was disproven when the FBI files and some of the LA District Attorney files became visible to the public. The book also proposed that Wilson had been involved in the murder of Georgette Banderdorf.
Okay, what are with these names?
It's just a fancy person.
I love it.
What is with these names?
Gilmore claimed that Elizabeth and Georgette had known each other because they both worked as hostesses at the same nightclub. However, Georgette had been dead for 2 years before Elizabeth even moved to Los Angeles in 1946.
Well.
Wilson was never a suspect in the Black Dahlia case until Gilmore brought it to the LAPD's attention. It seems like it wasn't worth their time. In Donald Wolfe's book, The Mob, The Mogul, and The Murder That Transfixed Los Angeles, Wolfe proposed that Wilson was present for Elizabeth Short's murder. Wolfe also claimed that Wilson was connected to the gangster Bugsy Siegel through some smaller gangsters who Wilson already knew. I gotta say, this suspect sucks.
Yeah.
Not for a second do I think that he had anything to do with this murder.
No.
So doesn't that mean that maybe he doesn't suck and he's better because he didn't murder someone?
Jump to conclusions, Matt, for this one.
It seems a bit like a J2C, Matt.
Yeah.
All right, Kelly.
Yes.
You want another George?
Bulbados?
Here you go.
Is it Bulbados?
No, it's not.
It's George Knowlton.
Oh, damn it.
Janice Knowlton was 10 years old and living in Westminster when Elizabeth Short's body was found. In her book, Daddy was the Black Dahlia Killer. I'm hoping and assuming this wasn't a children's book.
I don't think it was, but it'd be great if it was.
She came out to say that she was sure that her long-dead father, George Knowlton, had killed Elizabeth Short. Janice said that she had witnessed her father beat Elizabeth to death with a claw hammer in their garage in Westminster.
Humdinger.
I mean, if you look at the coroner's report from last week,
claw hammer,
you'd see that that probably didn't happen.
No.
Right there, but I'll continue. She also said that her father had been having an affair with Elizabeth and that she had used the garage as a bedroom. And that I don't put past her. So she can sleep anywhere.
Really?
Chairs?
Movie theaters.
Movie theaters.
Yeah.
It's true.
People's houses of parents.
Okay.
She claimed further that her father forced her to join him when they disposed of her body.
Ooh.
How come she didn't come forward sooner? Janice claims to recall all of this after her mother and stepmother died in the late 1980s. She said that she remembered her father molesting her, and she remembered seeing her father with a dismembered infant and burying a woman in their basement.
Whoa.
Jesus.
That he had threatened to throw her into the furnace and kill her mother if she ever told anyone what she witnessed. While going to therapy, Janice allegedly began seeing mental images of Elizabeth Short. Quick note, this was the 1980s, which was the high point of regression hypnosis therapy as accepted
before
practice.
Before it had been disproven completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of this sounds like satanic panic, you know, these are things that kids were seeing, cut up babies, etc.
Well,
just saying.
I mean, that doesn't mean that this is absolutely the case.
That's
here.
Very true. Let me continue. Janice claimed that she had often accompanied her father to Elizabeth's apartment, supposedly becoming close with her and referring to her as Aunt Betty.
Oh.
George had allegedly used his daughter as a, quote, cover when they disposed of her body. Janice said that George first tried to dump Elizabeth's body in the ocean by the Seal Beach Pier, but later disposed of her body in Los Angeles because it wouldn't sink into the water.
Yeah, dad's bodies are buoyant.
They float. in her book, she stated that she turned up circumstantial evidence, including the LAD's initial search for a suspect named George who drove a tan car.
Round up all the Georges. According to figure out if they drive tan cars.
You know, I'm telling you, it was Bulbados, and he made a break for the Oregon coast afterwards.
You're more right than you think. According to Janice, her father drove a tan LaSalle. Janice also stated that Ted Driscoll, who claimed to have dated one of Elizabeth Short's roommates, remembered meeting a man named George at Elizabeth Short's apartment. Quote,
"The physical description he gave to several of his neighbors before he passed fits George Knowlton to a T, right down to the fact of the compulsive deer hunting, the work in a foundry, and having come from a New England town near where Short was born."
Janice's co-author, Michael Newton, told the LA Times in 1993, quote, "To have another George who fits that description, to me, would be almost coincidental beyond the realm of possibility."
Agreed.
I mean, I think it's a certainty.
I don't know. Let's start with the name. I did some quick research and discovered that George was the 16th most popular and first male name.
It was real common.
In 1947.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a certainty that there was another George out there that fit that description.
I think it's very possible. In 1991, Janice convinced the Westminster police detectives to search for evidence of the murder by excavating a vacant lot where her home had stood years before. However, the police found no significant evidence of the crime. Janice died at the age of 67 on March 5th. 2004 in her home. The Orange County Coroner's Office classified her death as a suicide from the combined effect of 5 drugs.
Oh.
Her stepsister told the Times in late 2004 that she didn't believe that she meant to kill herself, also adding that Janice's alleged memories had put strain on their family. Quote, "Her book was trash and it wasn't even true."
Trash and untrue.
She believed it, but it wasn't reality. "I know because I lived with her father for 16 years. Robert Redmanley. Remember the salesman with the pregnant wife at home?
Yeah. God,
why are there so many awful humans involved in this story?
The last person to see her alive. Let's attempt to clear his name just a little bit more. He was detained and released after passing 2 polygraph tests. Manley had previously been discharged from the army for mental disabilities, suffering from nervous breakdowns, and had supposedly been struggling with auditory hallucinations. His wife eventually committed him to Patton State Hospital in 1954, and he died January 16th, 1986, due to a, quote, accidental fall. Honestly, I don't know how I feel about Red. He could have just been a super cool cucumber on that lie detector.
He seems so likely.
No, it was Dr. George Hodel.
Let's think about this for one more second. This, quote, accidental fall? I don't know the details surrounding this event, but I could wildly speculate that he was assassinated by the LAPD to cover up something.
So,
oh, yeah. No, that's definitely what happened.
Did Hodel have connections to the LAPD?
Get over Hodel.
Well, we know that he did it.
I mean, can I get there? Norman Chandler, publisher of the LA Times at the time. He was written about in Donald Wolfe's book, The Mob, The Mogul, and The Murder That Transfixed Los Angeles. In a complicated scenario involving multiple perpetrators, Wolfe claims that Chandler impregnated Elizabeth Short while she was working as a call girl for Brenda Allen, the notorious Hollywood madam, and that this led to Chandler organizing the gangster Bugsy Siegel to murder Elizabeth Short. However, the Los Angeles County District Attorney files plainly stated that Elizabeth Short was not a prostitute, like I said, and was not pregnant at the time she died.
Yeah, but they could have falsified those files.
Very possible.
This one, it seems like it's in the sense that none of us are that important.
Yeah.
Most of us aren't important enough to have a murder conspiracy.
No, I completely agree.
Crop up around us. And she definitely was not either.
Well, while we're all here stretching out, here's a big one. Remember Susan Degnan? She was the person killed in Chicago that Elizabeth was potentially obsessed with.
Yeah.
Well, due to the manner of death and the time frame, it's possible that they were actually killed by the same person. LAPD Captain Donahue openly expressed that he believed the two murders could have been connected. Elizabeth Short's body was found on Norton Avenue, 3 squares west of Degnan Boulevard. Again, this was the last name of Susan. There also seemed to be similarities between the written work for the Degnan payoff note and the letters received in the Black Dahlia case. They also both contained a comparative deformed letter P. and had a word form for magazine clippings in the exact same way. Both Suzanne Degnan and Elizabeth Short had been dismembered and drained of their blood, while William served life in jail for Suzanne's murder. Some feel that he could have also killed Short, but this is impossible, guys. He was in jail on January 15, 1947. However, some theorize that William was innocent of both murders and that the true serial killer was never convicted.
So it was the same person that killed both, it just wasn't William.
Yes!
I mean, that makes sense. I could buy that.
It's not just the doctor.
It's Hodel.
Reading anything into it is reading too much into it. All
right. Finally, let's wrap up on our cop thoughts here. Agnes Underwood had been with the Herald Express for 12 years when the Dahlia case happened. Ray Guise, an LAPD homicide detective lieutenant, prodded Aggie in the direction of Short's case while the LAPD continued to search down leads. She covered the interview for the first suspected arrest in Elizabeth Short's murder. This is Robert Red Nanley. The story, quote,
"Red tells own story of romance with Dahlia,"
ran in the Herald Express, and Aggie got the byline. The morning following the interview with Manley, Aggie was suddenly taken off the case.
Whoa.
It would take 2 days for her to be reassigned. However, she was almost immediately pulled off again. This time,
permanently.
Yeah.
Nice. I saw that
one
coming.
I don't like it.
Aggie was shocked as she was assigned to work at the city desk instead. After all, she had been one of the first women to hold city editorship on a major metropolitan daily in the United States. She'd worked there for 12 years, and now she's got desk duty?
It stinks. I don't like it.
You know who Aggie kind of reminds me of?
Peggy from Mad Men?
Yep.
Just because of the name. Okay.
Yep.
One theory
same thing.
I guess.
Woman kinda. In a man's world.
Sure. One theory behind why Aggie had been removed from the Black Dahlia case is that she was getting too close to finding out the truth. If the LAPD had been trying to protect the killer, they would have pulled her off the case, you know? He's hot on the trail.
Too good.
The theory
of
a police cover-up was also addressed in the 1949 grand jury investigation that I mentioned earlier. They convened early in the year to both investigate Short's murder and evaluate the possibility of police corruption or cover-up. The 21 jurors did not have a suspect to indict for Elizabeth Short's murder. Even with the evidence presented, they named Leslie Dillon as their prime suspect.
Yeah, but it's 49. It's not like an investigation a decade after. The people that were corrupt in 47 are still hanging around and corrupt in 49.
While there was plenty of circumstantial evidence to deem him Elizabeth's murderer, there was two reasons he was not brought to trial. One was that illegal detention that they gave him. Remember when they roughed him up a bit?
Yeah. None of that's admissible.
And number two, the lack of concrete evidence. They got nothing. In the event of a trial actually occurring, a few witnesses were willing to come forward to say that Dillon was in San Francisco during the time of the murder. The LAPD believed these witnesses lacked credibility and did not want them to convince the jury that Dillon was innocent. In 1949, the grand jury report found the following concerning police corruption. I've got a quote. You want to be a judge, Sam?
Yeah, I'll be a judge. I can be a judge. It's going to be a Southern judge.
Oh, no.
Deplorable order, conditions. Order. Conditions indicating corrupt practices and misconduct by some members of the law enforcement agencies in the county. Alarming increase in the number of unsolved murders, jurisdictional disputes, and jealousies among law enforcement agencies.
It's just the end of the sentence, I guess.
I guess that's where it stops.
Fantastic. To this day, the grand jury has never indicted a suspect for the murder of Elizabeth Short. On the bright side, the grand jury findings did bring to light an avalanche of police corruption at the highest ranks. Jealousy and secrecy were common amongst members of the LAPD at the time, causing case information to often not be passed on properly. This was very common even up through 1970 and even into the 80s before information was able to be easily passed on.
Electronically, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
I gotta rewatch LA Confidential is what I gotta do.
The LAPD received a shakeup throughout the entire system, including the dismissal of police chief Clemens Horrell from the LAPD. So, Sam.
Yes.
So, Kelly.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Hodel.
I don't think we'll ever know.
I mean, I'm with both of you. Either it's George Hodel, the Sting recordings, the, quote, drug overdose secretary, years of sexual assault, the son's books of evidence. Yeah, I definitely think it's him. But if it isn't, I'm with Sam. I think that it's someone that got away with the perfect murder.
I mean, it wasn't a perfect murder. It was just you got away with it because of the way the crime was investigated in 1947.
It was a different time. I'd love to hear your thoughts, though, listeners. Let's solve this case at FrightDay.club.
I mean, if one of you can actually solve it, that would be the greatest
thing
ever. Let's
crack it wide open. And you're welcome, Kelly.
Byron, thank you so much. It was Hodel, though.
Oh, of course. Guy was a terrible man that did a lot of awful things to a lot of people.
It was a great report.
Well, but there were a lot of people that did a lot of awful things in that story, but Hodel just was the one that did it. Yeah, thank you, Byron. That was really excellent.
You're very welcome. You know, a lot of really great things have happened this month.
Yeah.
But this moment right now, the release of Creep 2.
It's pretty good.
A highly anticipated moment. I'm very happy to finally talk about this movie.
Yeah, this has definitely been something I've been looking forward to for a really long time.
Let's review Creepy Crawly 2. Creep 2?
We hope you're enjoying your visit here this evening. Now, on with the show.
Creep 2 is a 2017 American found footage horror film directed by Patrick Bryce, written by Bryce and Mark Duplass. Sam, could you tell me a little bit about this movie?
A video artist looking for work drives to a remote house in the forest to meet a man claiming to be a serial killer. But after agreeing to spend the day with him, she soon realizes that she made a deadly mistake. That was a coy description.
Sequels always worry me, especially when it's a sequel to a movie that I like a lot.
Especially when it's a movie that you love.
So we love Creep. Everyone loves Creep.
Right. There are different ways that sequels can be done. I think the format that gives sequels the most hope is when it's the same crew returning, right? We've got the same actors, the same writers, the same directors. And that was the case with this one. A few switcheroos, but for the most part, same team.
We got Desiree on board.
Yeah. Good addition. But I was still real nervous. When the camera started to roll, within about 2 minutes, I'm like, ah, we're fine. No cause for concern.
Joseph is the most lovable.
Oh, what a charmer.
You just like the guy, and you know, because you saw Creep 1, that he's not a good guy.
The weirdest thing is, no matter what awful things he's done, I kind of felt for him when he was having this sort of down moment about his career choice.
Midlife crisis.
Yes. Only someone like Joseph could cut open a man and then make me feel bad for him.
It's funny, though. They have a way, and the way Mark Duplass plays Joseph, you're kind of pulling for him. And when he lets you down, it's not when he kills people. It's when he just lies. Wow. He's just an insane pathological liar.
He's pretty good at it. He keeps you on your toes.
And it's, you know, it's just sad. You know, come on, Joseph. Duplass, he makes Joseph of a level with Michael Myers and Jason and take your pick. Just an incredible protagonist.
You got the Scream mask. You got the hockey mask. You got
Peach Fuzz.
Throw that up on
the
wall.
Come on, Peach Fuzz.
There's something about the way Mark Duplass plays Joseph, too. He really made the character his own in the first movie, but he had the freedom to really expand on this personality in such an amazing, yet still pretty subtle way in the second film.
We do get to learn a lot more about Joseph in Creep 2. And it's kind of a built-in, reasonable exposition venue because he is documenting his life with the help of this videographer. Yeah, we're supposed to learn about him. He's supposed to be talking and telling us these things. And the best thing about it is you have no idea at any point how much of it is true.
He really is like pouring his heart out.
Or what passes as a heart.
Yeah, and what passes as reality.
And you start to inhabit his reality, and it's just weird.
It's funny because though I found him a little bit endearing in the first movie, by the end of this movie, I just really liked him. I actually felt bad for him, like when he was trying to talk her out of leaving at one point. Mm-hmm. I'm like, don't.
I think we had similar feelings when he was doing the same thing to Patrick in the first movie.
Yeah.
Right.
But it was a little bit more obviously malicious, right?
Right. There was this hint of love in this one that made it just enough different.
This is a love story.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about Desiree?
She's a unique woman.
Oh, Sarah's great.
She's very brave.
And we discussed this a little bit in our interview. She's brave, but she's also a little bit manipulative. And I think that that's why she is so drawn to Joseph.
Because he is a master manipulator.
As he's going by in this film, Aaron.
Yeah.
Kind of fun, but also really hard to talk about without the visual.
Yeah.
And I don't want to explain a lot of the reasoning behind the things he does. I think that that's more fun for you to see unravel in the film.
And guess that and try to predict.
But he has changed his name. And he does, like, obscure jam music.
Yes. And that's... I love... I mean, like, I hate the music so much, but it's so perfect. I couldn't fault him for that. It's just perfect for who he's become, for the man bun wearing.
You don't like...
Jam bands all sound the same.
I thought it was a made-up jam band, wasn't it?
It's Albert Natural playing Sarah Loves Her Juicy Fruit.
Yeah, but Albert Natural was a band that was made up for the movie.
You know, you never know.
No, it was. It was.
Just saying.
It was. It has to have been.
It's a hell of a song.
It's literally my only gripe with this movie at all was I wish they would have used a good axe. It was a shitty axe.
Was that a bad axe?
It was a terrible axe.
Is that like a Harbor Freight axe?
Basically, it was a Collins axe. Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay, so it has a brain.
Yeah, not good. You pick that up at Sears or Ace.
Patrick's not listening. That's so embarrassing for him.
It is. It probably is.
Oh. Instead of a bathtub, we have a hot tub scene, which I thought was actually pretty interesting. It really kicked in this bond between Sarah and Aaron.
You can't, again, we don't really want to talk too much about it, but sure. The dynamic that was developing between them, that was a pivotal moment. Mm-hmm. And it could have gone, you know, one of two ways.
And it may have went a third
way. Yeah, and it potentially went a third or fourth way.
Well, Sarah's character is so good at breaking down these walls of sad people.
Well,
and I think she saw Aaron as a challenge.
She did, but I think that evolved over the course of the story. So obviously Aaron's this unpredictable wild card, right? You're never really sure what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. You know that he's capable of lying to a creepy, skillful level. But suddenly, I think Sam actually said this out loud while we were watching it together. It's like, holy shit, has he met his match? Is she going to out-crazy him? And she is.
She was there to play.
The number of points where I was like, I would have been gone. Nope, I would have been gone again. Nope, that would have been it. And to me, that was demonstrative partially of her bravery, but even more so of her desperation to be a respected artist.
And she was kind of failing up until this point.
You just don't know her motivations. Like Kelly said, you just realize that she's potentially as much of a sociopathic manipulator as Aaron is, you know, slash Joseph. I keep saying Joseph because that's like you say, like at the beginning, her motivations seem very, very clear. She wants her YouTube show to be popular. Mm-hmm. And it's not. It's dumb. And has a chance.
It's not great.
Yeah. And she has a chance to do something that will potentially get her a lot more views. So she's all in. But then, wow, is that the only reason that she's here?
We're not really sure 100% of the intentions of anyone on screen the entire time, which makes for a really interesting movie.
Yep. And you don't know her well enough to know how far she's willing to go.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to do... We aren't going to do dead giveaways.
You know, I don't know if we really need to, honestly.
I think that's fine. I do want to talk to you guys about it.
But. Okay, we'll talk after the show.
Okay.
Do you have anything else to say about Creep 2? I mean, honestly, it's really hard to talk about without going into the motivations of the characters directly. But the bottom line is we've got a successful follow-up that somehow finds a way to elevate itself slightly, but still on the surface is the same movie.
And this is, I mean, obviously this is no surprise, but sets the stage for the third in the trilogy.
Please.
I was I don't even want to say I was surprised because it's not like I expected it to be bad. I was happy that I didn't have to be the least bit disappointed that we got a second round of this one. And I was left at the end of it very thrilled that we were going to get a part 3.
Maybe. We're still in the maybe.
I really, really liked this movie. Sarah was the perfect match for Joseph and created a tension that was even more intense than the one that was presented in the first movie. I can't wait to see if this does go to a third level, what it goes to. And I'm very happy I got to revisit the world of Joseph in Creep 2. I give this movie 8.1 glasses of Francis Ford Coppola wine.
All right. Patrick Bryce, he's the master of building uncomfortable tension and holding it. I love what he's done for the found footage genre, a genre that relies on jump scares, and then basically making fun of that. Mark Duplass, his Joseph character, he's my favorite slasher.
Really?
But I mean, you know me and Mark.
Yeah, that's true. I think Peach Fuzz might be my favorite. I don't know if Joseph is, but Peach Fuzz is.
Possibly my favorite movie of the year. 9
Whoa!
Sticks of juicy fruit.
Whoa!
I want more Peach Fuzz.
I agree with everything both of you have said. I was blown away by the first movie. Creep 2 delivered all the same and more. Small movie. It feels very intimate. It's stripped down and it's just the elements of what makes something scary. The constant questioning of someone's motives, the unpredictability of humans generally. And it's done perfectly. This is a great, great movie. Thank Patrick Bryce and Mark Duplass for bringing us these characters. I'm going to give this movie 8.8 rubber werewolf masks.
And those are our thoughts on Creep 2, which as of October 24th, which has probably passed by the time this is up, you can watch this now on VOD platforms. But if it's playing in your city...
Oh, see it on a big screen, you lucky SOB.
Come on. But I want to know what you think of this movie. Tweet us at FrightDay on Twitter or leave a comment below this episode in the show notes at FrightDay.com. Let's dig into it. Spoiler free, obviously, in our Facebook group, Facebook.com/group/FrightDay or FrightDay.club. Instagram's a thing that we have. A lot of you have been hopping on there joining us.
Oh, it's fantastic.
We might have to do one of those Instagram live streams pretty soon.
Ooh,
that'd be a
fancy.
Lot of fun. Captain Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies EVP episode one more time is available to our Patreon patrons at the $4 or higher level, along with a lot of shows, including next week's Monday release. You're getting another episode of Byron's Serial Corner. So if you enjoyed yourself this episode and last, you're going to want to... hop over there. Patreon.com/FrightDay. There's a lot of other great things there. I'm actually pretty excited for the cool stuff that we're doing.
How could you not be excited for the cool stuff that we're doing?
I feel like we're finally coming into it on Patreon.
Well, by we mean you. Literally, you guys have no idea how many hours Byron has spent editing this month.
It.
I feel
it's
so bad
fine.
For the man.
No, don't.
Oh, sympathy's your weakness.
And if you like the show and want to help us make it even better, of course you can grab something spooky at shop.frightday.com. It may seem like right now is the only time you're able to wear spooky clothes, and I know it's a great excuse, but here on Friday, we're keeping it going year-round. So show your support, okay? Make us not look so weird when we're wearing ghosts on our body.
Yeah, if we're all weird, then nobody's weird.
Another thing on Patreon, Sam, you've got a big update on your book.
Chipping away at it and putting up what I have for people who may be interested in it.
Yeah, that's for folks at the $20 and higher level?
It's at the $4,000 level and higher.
The special thanks?
I value myself highly.
All right, it's at the dollar level
it's
now.
It's at the dollar level.
Just kicked it down, Sam.
Okay, it's because Sam loves all of you and he really wants to share this with all of you. And it actually is meaningful that he's sharing it with you.
And in fact, Sam, I know you say this every time. If people can't afford to support us on Patreon.
Oh, yeah. We'll get it to you. Don't worry about it.
Sam@FrightDay.com, right? But most helpful of all, are those reviews on iTunes? That's the best way to get us in front of new eyes and inside of their ears, like the Slither Monster. Is that where he goes? Does he go in the ear?
Hmm?
James Gunn's Slither.
I don't watch that movie.
Good one. Corb Lund and the Hurt and Albertans or the bar band on that.
Now, what's really funny is that sounds familiar to me.
Where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me at Kelly Frightday on Twitter. You can always email me, kelly@frightday.com.
I am at Sam Frightday on Twitter. Email me, sam@frightday.com. On Instagram, sam_MiloDragovich.
And I'm Byron McCoy on Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, pretty much everywhere. Once again, not doing Snapchat anymore. I don't know why I keep saying it. It's habit. This October is crescendoing around us. And I just want to say thank you so much to our writers.
Especially to our writers. Holy cow.
At FrightDay.com.
Alex and Elizabeth and Maggie and Abby and Felicia. Thank you guys so much.
Amazing. All of you. Love you.
But also, I'm really happy that I got to do this with you guys. No matter how hard this month has been on us, it's been a lot of fun.
I'm right there with you. Alive, I mean.
So thank you guys so much for listening. And until next Fright Day, I'm Byron.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Sam.
Highly incriminating statement. A highly incriminating statement. Am I saying that right? Doesn't feel right.
Do we have to go back into Byron's cereal corner?
You want to say that one more time?
Do we have to go back? A little bit of something that's better than nothing.
It didn't have black?
Oh, it's Matchbox 20. She's got a little bit of something. God, it's better than nothing.
Better than nothing. She only sleeps when it's raining. She lives in Seattle, so it's all right. She gets well rested. Right?